This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The search continues for victims of Tuesday's collapse of a major highway bridge in the U.S. city of Baltimore. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to press ahead with Israel's offensive. He blasted a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a pause to the fighting, saying Tuesday that it had emboldened Hamas to reject a separate ceasefire proposal. As the war in Gaza grinds through a sixth month, each side has publicly insisted that its own idea of victory is in reach and rejected international efforts to stem the bloodshed. Israel says it can achieve its aims of dismantling Hamas and return scores of hostages as it expands its ground offensive to the crowded city of Rafah. He said it would hold on to the hostages until Israel agrees to the end of the war. Meanwhile,
statement is inaccurate in almost every respect, and it is unfair to the hostages and their families.
New Zealand joins U.S. and Britain in alleging it was targeted by China-backed cyber espionage.
New Zealand officials say hackers linked to the Chinese government targeted its parliament in 2021. The allegation Tuesday comes a day after American and British authorities announced a set of criminal charges and sanctions against seven hackers, all believed to be in China, who they say targeted U.S. officials, journalists, corporations, and pro-democracy activists. Britain accused the hackers of trying to break into the email accounts of UK lawmakers who were critical of China. U.S. Justice Department officials say the intention of the campaign was to harass critics of the Chinese government, steal trade secrets. And
that's VOA's Laurie London reporting. This is VOA News. Ukraine's Navy spokesman says that Ukrainian forces sunk or disabled a third of all Russian warships in the Black Sea, a major blow to Moscow's military capability as the war is dragged on. Ukraine's Navy spokesman told the Associated Press Tuesday that the latest strike on Saturday night hit the Russian amphibious landing ship that was resting in a dock in Russia-occupied Crimea. Ship was part of Ukraine's navy before Russia captured it after annexing the Black Sea Peninsula in 2014. Senegal's president-elect is vowing to fight corruption, rebuild institutions, and unite the country as he prepares to assume office. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has that story.
His first public address, Senegalese president-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye thanked his supporters and pledged to bring solutions to some of the problems he says his country is facing. Faye said it's time to bring calm to the country after outgoing President Macky Sall tried to postpone the February elections until December, plunging the country into a brief political crisis. Sunday's official election results have not yet been published, but Faye's supporters say they are satisfied with what they have seen so far. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday seemed likely to preserve access to a widely used abortion medication, AP correspondent Sagar Magani reporting.
Abortion opponents want the High Court to ratify a conservative appeals court ruling limiting access to mifepristone. But in their first abortion case since overturning Roe v. Wade 2 years ago, the justices appeared to reach consensus that those challenging the FDA's approval of the medication don't have the legal right to sue. If the justices find the challengers lack standing, they'd leave in place current rules allowing patients to get the drug through the mail and take it to induce an abortion through 10 weeks of pregnancy. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Shares of Donald Trump's social media company rose about 16% in the first day of trading, boosting the value of Trump's large stake in the company, as well as the smaller holdings of fans who purchased shares as a show of support for the former president. Trump Media and Technology Group runs the social media platform Truth Social, but has yet to turn a profit. Trump holds a nearly 60% stake in the company. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
out of the Qatar ceasefire talks.
I don't really think that the sticking point here is Hamas. It's the unwillingness of the Israeli government to make any concession.
A major bridge in Baltimore collapses after being hit by a freighter.
This is no ordinary bridge. This is one of the cathedrals of American infrastructure. It has been part of the skyline of this region for longer than many of us have been alive.
And handwritten notes are making a comeback. But they aren't really handwritten.
But now a company based in Phoenix has revived that tradition with robots.
Today is Wednesday, March 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Riot police dispersed hundreds of Jordanian demonstrators who were marching in support of Palestinians in Gaza on Tuesday as they headed toward the Israeli embassy in Amman. Tuesday, Israel pulled out of the ceasefire talks in Qatar, which also sparked demonstrations in Israel. In Tel Aviv, a crowd of hostages' families and their supporters gathered outside the Israeli Defense Headquarters on Tuesday, demanding a deal be made to release their loved ones.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is more focused on his survival as a prime minister, on his survival as a free citizen. He's more concentrated on his trial than to release the hostages.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to press ahead with Israel's offensive. He blasted the UN Security Council resolution calling for a pause in the fighting, saying Tuesday that it had emboldened Hamas to reject a separate ceasefire proposal. At the Pentagon, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
In Gaza today, the number of civilian casualties is far too high, and the amount of humanitarian aid is far too low.
For his part, Gallant reiterated the Israeli position.
Over the past 6 months, we have been fighting a war against a brutal terror organization, Hamas, which is the ISIS of Gaza.
The Israel Defense Forces top spokesperson on Tuesday confirmed that the deputy commander of the Hamas military wing, Marwan Issa, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in the central Gaza Strip earlier this month. Joining us now to talk about the collapse of the ceasefire talks in Qatar is Michael Provins from the University of California, San Diego. He teaches modern Middle East history, focusing on the 20th century Arab East. So Israel wasn't happy with the Security Council, as you know. It appears that the talks have collapsed. Israel at least pulled out.
Yeah.
They never really wanted a ceasefire anyway, did they?
No. I mean, the Israelis don't have any cards left to play diplomatically. They don't have another great power patron to call. And the Israeli public will punish Netanyahu for maybe not today and maybe not tomorrow, but sometime soon for getting Israel on the bad books of the Biden administration in a crisis period. That's happened before. It's been a long time, but it's happened before. It happened in the 90s, and it was a Likud prime minister, Yitzhak Shamir, who refused to let George Bush the First keep his promises to some of the Arab countries that had been part of his coalition in the 1991 Gulf War. And Shamir, you know, he was swept from power. He was defeated. So, you know, there's a precedent for that kind of thing, and Netanyahu's got to be pretty worried. But he doesn't have anything left to do, and so I think that it was a predictable response on the part of his government.
So what about Hamas in all of this? You know, they also don't seem to have a play here.
Well, I mean, I think that they haven't had a play at all ever during the course of the conflict, this most recent part, since October. I mean, Hamas, if the Israelis withdraw and have a ceasefire, they'll call it a victory. But, you know, it's not a victory to anybody in Gaza, obviously, not with tens of thousands, something like, you know, 35, 40,000 people dead and millions of people homeless with the infrastructure destroyed. So, and I think that Netanyahu and the people who are closest to him want to deny, they'd like to eliminate Hamas, which is impossible. It's a political party. I mean, it's an organization. It's a movement. It's all these things. So, you know, the idea that it can be eliminated by a third party is, I think, not really credible. And of course, they knew that all along. But they staked their goal on the elimination of Hamas. The Americans are a little bit more nuanced about it. They say the elimination of Hamas's capability as a military force. The Israeli public is supposedly supportive of the military campaign, but they're not supportive of losing the support of the United States.
Where do the other major players from the Arab states stand on this? Couldn't they intervene with Hamas?
Well, I don't think that. Hamas says that their position is that the Israelis need to talk seriously about releasing prisoners and evacuating and declaring a ceasefire for an extended period of time. And the Israelis are unwilling to do any of those things. And those are not really, the thing is that the Israeli government, especially the coalition partners of Netanyahu that are on the far right and the settler groups and people like that, they're talking about going back to Gaza and building beachfront property in a depopulated coastal paradise. So, you know, and the Netanyahu government has said repeatedly, no, we're back and we're going to stay. Well, this is not going to be acceptable to Hamas, and it's not going to be acceptable to any of the Arab states. The goalposts are not changing. They're the same as they've been, and from the perspective of Netanyahu, he didn't like him, and he didn't accept him, and he still doesn't accept him. So I don't really think that the sticking point here is Hamas. It's the unwillingness of the Israeli government to make any concession on any level to any Arab party, which has been entirely consistent in Netanyahu's career for the last 30 years, entirely unwilling to make any concession to any Arab state or party, period.
Thank you so very much.
My pleasure, anytime.
Michael Provence from UC San Diego. In the U.S. city of Baltimore, which is on the mid-Atlantic East Coast, a container ship lost power and slammed into a major bridge, causing it to collapse. At least 6 people are feared dead, the bridge destroyed, blocking a very busy port, trapping ships in the harbor, and preventing others from coming in. According to the state of Maryland, more than 30,000 people use the bridge for their daily commute.
A Singapore-registered vessel with the name Dali, D-A-L-I, which made contact with the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, Maryland, at around 1:30 a.m. this morning.
That's U.S. National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy. Also at the scene, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg.
This is no ordinary bridge. This is one of the cathedrals of American infrastructure. It has been part of the skyline of this region for longer than many of us have been alive. So the path to normalcy will not be easy. It will not be quick. It will not be inexpensive. but we will rebuild together.
U.S. President Joe Biden made a televised address to the nation about the accident as well.
We're going to send all the federal resources they need as we respond to this emergency. I mean, all the federal resources. And we're going to rebuild that port together.
A number of cars and trucks fell into the water from the bridge when the ship struck the span. Recovery efforts continue. Following these other stories from around the world, a major Venezuelan opposition group has registered a candidate for July's presidential election to ensure a spot on the ballot, even though the primary winner and her alternate were unable to sign up. The broad opposition coalition was left without an elected candidate after Maria Corina Machado, who won the opposition nominating contest by a landslide last year to run against incumbent President Nicolas Maduro, was banned from running, prompting the reimposition of some U.S. sanctions. A British court says Julian Assange can't be extradited to the United States on espionage charges unless U.S. authorities guarantee he won't get the death penalty. The ruling is a partial victory for the WikiLeaks founder. Russian officials continue to say Ukraine and the West had a role in last week's deadly Moscow concert hall attack, despite vehement denials of involvement by Kyiv and a claim of responsibility by an affiliate of the Islamic State group. While most of the world looks to electric cars as a clear path to fighting global warming, there's a problem with electric cars in Africa, one of the hardest hit regions in terms of global warming. Now, while electric vehicles can lower pollution and save drivers money, Senatorid reports that uneven access to electricity is a significant barrier to their success on the African continent.
Linda Mate grew up with a love for motorbikes. She says she wanted to challenge the stereotype that bikes were for men. However, her first attempt at riding one almost got her injured, so she quit.
Like, you can easily get your leg somewhere bent because of the exhaust pipe. When you're getting down and you get off from at that side of the exhaust pipe, yeah, you get yourself bent.
In 2019, Marte was introduced to electric bikes, reigniting her childhood interests. She has since been working as a bike courier in Ghana's capital, Accra. She says electric bikes are easier to operate than gasoline-powered motorcycles. The challenge, she says, is keeping her bike charged.
But with the kind of work we do, the deliveries and stuff, if you charge at home and you're out in town and you run out of battery, then you have to go back home and charge. No.
Instead, Marte swaps low batteries for fresh ones at these stations run by Ghanaian battery company Kofa. Motorcycles play a vital role in Africa, moving people and goods, especially in areas with limited public transport and road infrastructure. Industry experts say e-bikes are cheaper to run and pollute less than traditional motorcycles. But the World Bank says about half of sub-Saharan Africa is without electricity, and even places with electricity would struggle with a big increase in electric vehicles, according to Kofa founder Eric Nygaard.
They are struggling with this in the Western world. So when you plug, imagine everybody comes home at 5 o'clock and plugs their cars in. I mean, what it does is it creates an extreme electricity demand spike, which is quite intense. And so putting that pressure on the current grid systems across Africa would not work.
Instead, Kofa's batteries store electricity from solar panels and the national grid. Users can swap depleted batteries at any time at locations across the capital without putting pressure on the national grid. After 2 years of operation, Kofa swaps about 200 batteries in Accra daily.
And these batteries are almost like packets of energy that you could use anywhere.
Kofa says their batteries can also be used for household appliances and even power generators when the national grid goes down. The company says their batteries could potentially feed power back into the national grid to support the Electricity Company of Ghana, or ECG.
And so let's say you're in an area of Accra that they're going to do like ECG is going to shut it off. Potentially we could support the local distribution network and say, we will provide energy from our station to you.
COFA says they hope their technology will always make energy accessible and drive a quick adoption of e-vehicles in Africa. Sena Nutod, VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Senegal's president-elect, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, who just 11 days ago was in jail, is vowing to fight corruption, rebuild institutions, and unite the country as he prepares to assume office. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo is in Dakar and has this story.
In his first public address, Senegalese president-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye thanked his supporters and pledged to bring solutions to some of the problems he says his country is facing. I will govern with humility and in transparency, the president-elect said, adding, I will work to get rid of corruption in all sectors and will work toward rebuilding our institutions. Faye said it's time to bring calm to the country after outgoing President Macky Sall tried to postpone the February elections until December, plunging the country into a brief political crisis. He said the country needs national reconciliation and rebuilding our fundamental ways of living together. The pre-electoral crisis we lived through, he said, cost some people their lives and many were jailed. We hope to turn the page and reconcile people's hearts and the Senegalese people. Sunday's official election results have not yet been published, but Faye's supporters say they are satisfied with what they have seen so far. One supporter, Nyanya Fati, says we were hoping to win with over 70% in the first round, but it seems like we are 57%. It's only preliminary numbers, she adds. We hope the final number will be higher. Another Faye supporter, Sayer Kebe, says, we lived through a moment that almost pushed Senegal into chaos. But thank God everything is back in place now. We had a transparent presidential election. Earlier at the ruling party's coalition headquarters, Amadou Ba, the coalition lead candidate who lost the election to Faye, told reporters about a conversation he had with the president-elect.
Je lui souhaite.
Ba said, I wish him success and may God accompany him as he carries out his various missions and goals for our glorious nation and for the well-being of our population. As Ba's supporters try to digest their candidate's loss in the first round that saw 17 candidates vying for the top job, tensions of the last few months seem to be fading away and being replaced by the hope that Senegal's reputation as a beacon of democracy in the region will soon be restored. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And finally, there was a time, not too long ago, that most of us wrote letters by hand, thank you notes, letters to friends and family, almost everything we did. But like many things that changed with the invention of the personal computer, handwriting fell by the wayside. You know, by the time my son went to school, they didn't even teach handwriting anymore. Now, the very technology that killed handwritten notes is bringing it back. Here's Julie Tabo with this story.
Old-fashioned letter writing is making a comeback. While writing letters by hand were once part of day-to-day life, computers made the job easier and faster, leaving behind that personal touch. But now, a company based in Phoenix has revived that tradition with robots that use real pens to write letters in a style chosen by the user. David Wax is CEO and founder of Handwritten. He spoke with VOA via Zoom.
I think what's old is new again. Receiving a handwritten note appeals not only to your eyes, but the feel as well. And that means a lot.
Their main clients are businesses that use handwritten letters and thank you notes to create stronger connections with their customers.
The people we're really targeting are nonprofits. Helping a nonprofit receive a redonation. One of the biggest issues facing nonprofits is the redonation rate is sub 50%. The number one reason people don't redonate is they don't feel thanked. So we help these nonprofits reach out in a more meaningful way through handwritten notes.
Automated letter writing isn't new. President Thomas Jefferson used this polygraph device in the early 1800s so he could keep copies of his correspondence. Jefferson considered the machine a marvel of technology. An inventor himself, he recommended several improvements to his British manufacturers. 200 years later, the process includes machine learning and high-tech manufacturing.
The technology involved is 3D printing and laser cutting and electrical circuit board design for the robot itself.
And if users need help thinking of exactly what to write in their note, they can choose the AI Assist button to help them generate a better message through its ChatGPT function. While robots may never fully replace the personal touch of a handcrafted note, the team at Handwritten believes they come close. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. And you can download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
We come from nations large and small, east and west, developed and developing economies. But we're all united by a fierce conviction that democracy is the single most powerful tool for unleashing human potential and delivering results for our people, declared Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the recent Summit for Democracy in Seoul. There was a powerful wave of political opening around the world after the end of the Cold War. But that has been followed by nearly two decades of democratic backsliding in many places, said Secretary Blinken.
Basic freedoms have eroded. Electoral rights have come under assault. Corruption has eaten away at hope. Under the summit banner, over the past 3 years, we have risen together to meet this challenge. More than 100 governments from every part of the world have committed to taking concrete action to strengthen and renew democracy, both in their countries, but also working together to tackle shared threats around the world.
The United States is protecting independent media and journalists, observed Secretary Blinken.
The United States has supported grants around more than a dozen countries to strengthen the long-term stability of media outlets through the International Fund for Public Interest Media. And we're improving the security of journalists, including those operating in exile, under the Journalism Protection Platform.
The United States is also launching a new national action plan on responsible business conduct. This plan sets out more than 40 concrete actions across the U.S. government to help ensure that the companies that we work with are actually upholding human rights. If we want rising generations to support democratic societies, revitalizing democracy will also require us to shape a technological future that's promoting progress in people's lives, noted Secretary Blinken.
As authoritarian and repressive regimes deploy technologies to undermine democracy and human rights, we need to ensure that technology sustains and supports democratic values and norms.
Democracy doesn't happen by accident, declared Secretary Blinken. We have to renew it constantly. We do so secure in the knowledge that democracy is a shared aspiration for people around the world, and that demand for representative democracy remains strong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the